Hey, everybody, welcome, and I hope you're having a good night. And listen, I want to encourage you. As Lisa and I are away right now, catching up on some rest, and we're in the East Coast as I speak to you right now, but we have a special treat tonight. But before I let you know who or what this special treat's all about, again, I just want to remind all of you to be patient and to just take an extra spoon of grace as we go through these physical transformations here at Calvary. The Lord, and I'm so grateful for this, the Lord has allowed us all of these years, my goodness, for the last 26 and a half years now, to go through growing pains. We've always gone through them. Growing pains always requires changing, preparing, and coping with what God is doing next. Our God is on the move. He's never stagnant. He's never stale. He's always relevant. And that leads to part of the changes that are going on around us. As I mentioned last week to you, last Wednesday night, most of the changes happening or that shall happen will be changes that are internal, electronic, technology, that kind of stuff. But you will see probably a pretty amazing change physically to the sanctuary on the inside in the sense of colors and our ability to present a service. So we need you to be praying. Listen, even that, we need you to step up. We're going to be asking for your help. We are going to need special greeters for the next several months. We're going to need people like you see at the airport. We're going to need people directing others over to the tabernacle, over to the tent, and to the appropriate areas. We're going to need, listen to this. This is going to put us to a test here, but I'm confident. Part of the ministry needs that we have, believe it or not, is that we're going to need people in between Sunday services to help refresh the bathroom facilities that are going to be brought in. We're having trailers brought in that are going to be our bathroom facilities. They're actually amazing, but we're going to need servants for that. So you can pray about being involved in refreshing and having even the bathrooms maintained for a good witness. There's so much that we need help in. Please, please pray and get involved. It's your church. And so we ask you to invest yourself in that. Great changes. God is providing. It's amazing. And I'm just happy to report that you'll never hear, you're not going to hear as long as I'm alive, any campaign for money, any thermometer for development projects, not going to happen. Why? We always operate within our budget. God has provided. So we need to give Him the glory, right? So, church, tonight we have not only a very dear friend, a brother, a man I love. I follow this guy on Instagram and everything else he does. He's been here before. This guy is a defender of the faith. I just love him. And I know you do too. And if you've never met J. Warner Wallace, you're about to meet a legend. He's going to get embarrassed when I say this. But regarding a crime scene investigation, regarding some of America's cold cases, J. Warner Wallace is the man. He's a legend in the detective world and in law enforcement. Thank God he's a strong, born-again believer and a defender of the faith. But his books and his, and he'll talk about his books in a moment, Cold Case Christianity and all that's happening regarding that is off the charts awesome. So Calvary Chapel tonight, give a warm welcome to my good friend and your good brother, J. Warner Wallace.
I wish just a small part of that was actually true. That would be awesome if a small part was true. Yeah, we talked about deploying, right? And Morgan talked about that a little bit. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Since we've got a chance in the middle of the week to talk about how to be equipped and what we can do to share the truth of Christianity with others. You know, that's probably what we do. We did Fearless Faith conferences here a couple times now. And so we talk about these kinds of things, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Now, most of you know my work here in Los Angeles. I'll just kind of recap a little bit for you. I've been working cold cases mostly. I was not raised in the church. I was somebody who was raised in a family that was just not, no believers. And my dad is still a very committed atheist. And for the most part, that's the way I was raised. Believe me, I would be willing to go to church with my wife if she wanted to go to church. Because my dad was willing to go to church with his wife, because he thinks it's a very useful delusion. He thinks this is actually good for kids, right? He could raise up good kids. He'd be happy to come to my church to sing songs. He thinks he would rather live in a country in which there are Christians than a country in which there are none. That's just how he's always viewed Christianity. Now, I was working investigations like these, unsolved murders, when I first started looking at the case for Christianity. And I discovered something that I've shared with you before here. And it's informed the way I think about my Christian faith. And I hope tonight I can help inform the way you think about your Christian faith using some of these ideas. Now, as you know, my son Jimmy is still doing the same work that I did for years before him. He has my name. As you know, I only have one name in my family. I use it over and over and over again. And so he's using the same tools and the same uniform that I wore before him, and I'm wearing the same uniform and using the same tools that my dad did before me. And we've been at the same agency now for 56 years. And that's the thank you. Thank you very much. And if you want to kind of follow up, I'm only going to say this once. I didn't bring books tonight to do any of that. I just want you guys to laser in, focus in on what we're going to be talking about. And I will have some follow-up materials that are available on our website, which is just coldcasechristianity.com. And of course, we have a phone app and all the stuff that goes along with that. And if you want to reach out to ask me a question later on, you can do it by way of social media, okay? As a matter of fact, I'll give you a couple of ways to, if you wanted to tweet to me, you could do it right now, okay? And here's a suggestion. Any of those will work, actually. Any of those are good. J. Warner Wallace is the coolest guy ever. Is my favorite. Go ahead and just put that out there for everyone to see right now. Now, I think you guys know a couple of years ago or last year, believe it or not, they are filming right now God's Not Dead 3. Did you know that? Yeah, they are filming it right now. Last year, that was asked to do a small scene in God's Not Dead 2, in which we made the case for Christianity in about 6 minutes in a courtroom setting. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. If I asked you to make the case for what you believe as a Christian, are you ready to do it? Would your answer sound different than say, when I ask this question, I hate to tell you, I get the same answers all the time. Why you guys are Christian? I get the same answer all the time. I think I've shared it with you before at some of these smaller conferences we've done here. The most popular answer is always, because I was raised that way. That is the number one answer that Christians give. Their parents were Christians, they were raised in the church. That is the number one answer. The number two answer is, I've had an experience that demonstrated for me that Christianity is true. I either prayed for something that I received, a miracle occurred in front of me, something happened in my life that I interpreted as God's action in my life, and that's why I'm a Christian. Those are the two most popular answers that Christians give. Now think about it. Was that one of your explanations also? Your testimony, your own personal testimony? Because, you know, those are also the two most popular answers that Mormons give for why they think Mormonism is true. The two most popular answers that Muslims give, that Hindus give, that Buddhists give. All of us sound the same when it comes right down to it, unless, of course, we can make a case for what we believe evidentially. That only a few people can, as a matter of fact, only one group can do that. That's you guys, Christians. Now, we have a command in Scripture. Have you read this command? You see that Jesus is continually talking about getting out, right? And get into the world, the messy world around us. He says, you've heard it was said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. We are called continually to be in the world, even with people who don't like us. At the same time, do you get a sense that we're called to be careful about the world? You see this in 1 John here. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. So we have this weird kind of call, right? As you know, we talk about it this way. We are to be in the world, but what? Not of the world. That's right. I've been thinking about this a lot, right? How do you do that? Well, it turns out that there's a group out there right now that does this a lot. And many of you are in this room are part of that group. They're called first responders, right? These are the folks who are trained to be in the world all the time. They're called out at every rescue. If it's a medical response or a fire or what, speaking of fires, it took me 2 hours to get here tonight, right? I'm not that far from where you guys are, but man, it takes forever to get here because there's a fire between you and I. And these kinds of folks are trained to be in the world in a rescue capacity. At the same time, they're wearing uniforms that separate them from. They have a certain amount of training that separates them from the world. They should have a code of ethics. That's why when a cop does something you think is horrific, you're really upset. Why? Because you think he should have a better standard than that, and so do I. So there's a sense in which these folks should be in the world, but not of the world. They're called to be different. They're called to be set apart in a certain way. They're rescue personnel. Well, I've written about this in this book called Forensic Faith, and I think there are four ways that first responders can teach us to be better at being in the world but not of the world. And it comes down to these four characteristics of first responders. We know our duty, we train constantly, we investigate truth claims, and then we learn how to communicate these to others. And what we're going to do tonight is just talk about that last step, because that's all about evangelism, right? That's all about learning how to communicate what you believe to a world that doesn't even necessarily care what you believe. As a matter of fact, right now we are calling the culture post-Christian. Have you heard that expression? What it means is it's not that there's a vast number of people in the culture who have never heard the gospel. It's that there now are a vast number of people who are in the culture who have heard the gospel but reject it. They already understand what Christianity is, or they think they do, and they don't want anything to do with it. They're post-Christian. That's what we're up against. So I want to share with you a certain number of skills that might help you to communicate your Christian worldview. You ready? Now, this is a friend of mine named John Lewin. Most of my cases have been done with John. John is a very good friend. We've been working together for like 18 years. We still have cases. I have two I'd like to do with him right now, but I've just been tied up on other things. And John is just a bulldog of a guy. I mean, he is so tenacious. He is the best prosecutor, in my view, in the entire country. And I've learned some things from working with John in trials. Now, when he finally goes in front of the jury, this is what he says. Almost always, he begins his closing argument with these words. And I laugh because he said it so many times in front of me that I pretty much have it memorized. I'll put it on the screen for you. He says, "When Detective Wallace brings me a case, he has the difficult task of releasing it to me for the trial. All the effort he spent investigating and preparing the case for filing, it's all complete now. Now he has to hand the case over to me for the jury trial. I know it's difficult for him. It's hard for him to trust me with his hard work. In fact, I bet he still thinks he could have presented the case better than I did." That's true. I do think that. But he thinks he could have investigated it better than I did. So it's kind of an equal thing, right? Now, what he'll typically say in the very next line is, "As hard as it was for Detective Wallace to release this case and trust me with it, I now have to release it to you as the jury. And I'm feeling the exact same way that he did. All this work, I have to trust that you will now do the right thing." It's a really interesting process, communicating a claim to a jury. And people will ask me all the time, "Jim, where is it that you win these cases?" Now, I talked about this in a Q&A about a year and a half ago here. But I just want to remind, though, if you weren't in that Q&A, I want to remind you of where it is we win cases, because it'll help you better communicate the gospel. You know, is it in the opening statement? Our opening statements are long, sometimes 2.5-3 hours. But that's not where we win cases. If we don't win it in the evidence show, that could take 6 weeks, 8 weeks. We don't even win it in the closing argument or in the rebuttal. And it doesn't really even get fleshed out in the jury deliberation, if I'm honest. You know where we win cases? We win cases at jury selection. Ugh, is that terrible or what? Doesn't that just sound terrible? But it's true. You win. If you don't pick the right people to put on your jury, you are not going to get to a verdict. And both sides know this. And in California, we are allowed to exclude a certain number of potential jurors. Not every juror who walks in the door gets called, gets placed on a panel. You already know that if you've been on jury duty, right? Because you didn't make it on a trial, maybe. So I want to start with the first principle of communicating that's important, and that is you have to pick your jury with a great amount of insight. I'm looking for three things in jurors. I don't need PhDs. As a matter of fact, if you have a PhD, I'm probably not going to put you on the jury. That's your first way to get off, right? "I've got a PhD in philosophy." You're excused, okay? Right away, you're out. I don't want that guy. I'm looking for people who are passionate. I'm looking for people who are without a bias that would cause them to incline in one direction or the other unfairly. And lastly, I'm looking for people who are they're already changing sign language. Am I talking too fast? Is that why you had to change? It's only going to get worse. I'll do this every time. If I see you're sitting here, I'll just talk faster and faster and faster. You can't even keep up with me. You already mistranslated four words. Look how long. See? No, you're doing a great job. You're doing a great job. Have to give her a hard time. Third thing I'm looking for, though, is I'm looking for people who are humble. I'm looking for people who don't think so much of themselves that they won't hear the testimony offered by expert witnesses. Does that make sense? And sometimes your pride will keep you from hearing the truth. You know people right now who won't hear the gospel truth because they got a pride issue. I'm looking for jurors who are in those three categories. I want them to be passionate, interested. I want them to not be biased, and I want them to be humble enough to hear me. Look, I start off, I've only got so many spots in the jury, right? I've got 12 maybe in the box, four alternates if it's a long trial. So about 16 people I'm going to actually select. I'm going to have a ton of people come in on the day of jury selection. I got to figure out which of these people actually makes it into the box. And do you know how I decide that? Well, there's a spectrum. I have to consider the spectrum. In that room with all the potential jurors, there are two groups. There's a group that basically, I can divide it in half. Half of these are not in half. I'm not sure what the percentages is. It depends on the room. But some of these folks are going to be so pro-prosecution that they're really inclined to agree with the prosecutor. And then there's another group that is really pro-defense. And it's because maybe they had a good experience with law enforcement or a bad experience with law enforcement. Maybe they trust they've got a relative who's a prosecutor or a relative who's a defense attorney. For whatever reason, they are siding in one of these two camps. And then you can divide these two camps in half. So there are actually four. And number one, you've got people who are so pro-prosecution that I could almost do anything and they will side with me and they will find him guilty. They are homers. They are just going to stay with us. No matter what we do, they will trust us and believe everything we say. I would love to have a jury with just those people in it, right? Then there are people who are pro-prosecution, but they're fair. If there's not enough evidence to make the case, they will not find him guilty. Then there are people who are pro-defense, but they're also fair. And if there is enough evidence to find him guilty, they'll find him guilty. And then there are people who are so pro-defense that I don't care how good the evidence is, how good the case is, they're going to hang my jury or they're going to try to find a way to acquit him because they never trusted the cops to begin with. Okay. You know what we're trying to do when we select juries? Pretty simple, right? Because the defense does not want any number ones, and the prosecution does not want any number fours. We are trying to remove the edges. We want people in camps two and three. They might be inclined in one direction or the other, but they're fair and unbiased, and they will put aside whatever they're thinking to do the right thing. That's what we're looking for. Something similar happens when you're getting ready to share the truth of the gospel with people. You have the entire world who are out there who could be listening to you, in your office, in your school, in your friendships, your groups. And there are people out there who are already believers and people out there who aren't. And these two groups can be divided into two. So, number one, these are people who are Christians and they're so committed to Christianity, they don't even care if it's false. They don't even care if I could demonstrate it's false. I could get the body of Jesus and drag it around in front of them. They would say, I don't care. I like being a Christian. It works for us. We do all our family holidays together. I am not leaving. There are people at number two who are Christians, but they're starting to have doubts. They've got some open questions. And there are people who are atheists that are really starting to have doubts about whether their naturalistic perspective can actually explain the world around them. Then there are people who are in group four who not only are atheists, they are anti-theists. We do college presentations, right? Frank Turek has been here with you also, and we'll do a college presentation. And these folks will be in the back row live tweeting profanity at you. You won't even know until you get off the stage and you look at your Twitter feed. And you're thinking, really? Yeah, because they don't want there to be a God. This is the spectrum. And just like picking juries, I know whenever I'm talking about God or talking about Jesus in any group, only three of these four groups is paying attention. I call this the three-quarter principle. Now, I think we have to be very careful about juries. So before you get upset that you haven't been able to convince your uncle so-and-so or your aunt or whatever it may be, think about it. Where are they in the spectrum of juries? My dad is a number four, a very committed number four. I was a number four for a lot of years. Now, I have a strategy for all four groups. Here's how it works. If you're a number one, you might think, why do you even need to talk about the gospel with number ones? Why do you even need to make a case for why Christianity is true with number ones? They already get it. They'll even stop you. They'll say, Jim, you don't need to make that case for me. I'm already in. I believe this is true. I don't need it. Save it for somebody else. Really? I still offer the evidence for Christianity and talk about the gospel in front of number ones for a couple of reasons. Number one, just because you say you're a Christian does not mean you even know what the gospel is. So we need to share the gospel with people who think that they think they know what the gospel is, because they might be wrong. Two, you're number one? Okay, great. Do you have kids? Are they anywhere between junior high and college? Then you got a house full of twos. And they want to know if this is true. They've got questions. And by the way, they aren't going to read my stupid book. They're not going to read anyone's stupid book. They want to know from you, is this true? If God is the creator of everything, who created God? They want to know these simple questions. If God is so great, why did 58 people die in Las Vegas? They want to know. And they're not going to read my book. You, as a one, had better be prepared to answer the questions of all of your twos. So start paying attention. And of course, we're not threes. Threes are people who actually, we think we can actually talk about the gospel and help them make a decision. Now, what do you do with fours, though? That's the trick, right? Fours are basically a pain in the butt, okay? They are. Right? And you know this because if you've ever seen a four posting a blog or commenting on a blog, he is using profanity, right? I mean, they are obnoxious. And by the way, I never get upset about that. That's what fours do. Duh. I'm already over it. When I see a fours on my Twitter feed, I'm like, hey, I'm not like losing sleep over this. This is what fours do. But what do we do with fours? Well, I got one in my own family, my dad. Here's what you do with fours. You ready? It's profound. Write this down. You pray and you model for fours. You ask God to do something only God can do. And you model Christ. Even though it might take a long time. And if it's your dad you're working with, it might take 25 years of modeling Christ and praying for fours. And then if God grants your prayer and moves this person from four to three, they will remember everything you ever told them. And they'll be in a position to hear the gospel. But you don't move people from four to three. God moves people from four to three. So we got to be praying for those folks. As a matter of fact, when we take students to Berkeley, we tell them, before we go to Berkeley, you're going to encounter all kinds of people on the campus of Berkeley as we do some street evangelism, and you're going to encounter one, two, threes, and fours. And we explain to them what the differences are. And they're like, okay, we get it. So now when they show up to Berkeley, they're wearing shirts. I didn't make these, they made these. We'll pray for group four. But just picking your jury is probably not going to be enough. They have to know, we don't just pick a jury. We pick a jury, and then we give them jury instructions. Did you know that? It's a big, thick book in California. They are jury instructions that help jurors examine evidence because there are certain rules of evidence. I want to go through a few that will help you communicate the truth of the gospel to your friends. You have to know these truths about evidence before you can even make a case for Christianity. You ready? First one's really simple. There are two categories of evidence. If you've seen my presentations, you already know a lot of what I'm going to talk about, but I will just kind of cover it quickly for those of you who have not seen this before. There are only two kinds of evidence. You've got direct evidence and indirect evidence. That's very good. That makes sense, right? And direct evidence is just eyewitness testimony, and indirect evidence is all the other stuff. Indirect evidence is also called circumstantial evidence. So when I say I've got fingerprints, that's not direct evidence. If you think you have to have direct evidence to make a good case, really? I've never had a direct evidence case. My cases are all circumstantial. All. The only thing that counts as direct evidence is an eyewitness. Remember I told you this, I showed you this once a couple of years ago when I was here. If I'm making a case against this guy for a murder, I can make it one of two ways. I can ask a witness to tell me what she saw, and if she can identify what he did, I can make a case with just one piece of evidence, her eyewitness testimony. That would be a direct evidence case. But if it's a slightly different case, say, for example, he had a mask on his face at the time of the murder, well, now she cannot identify him. I don't have a direct evidence case. I have to build this a different way. I have to go and talk to him about his alibi, and I have to examine what I find in the search warrant, the bat, the clothing I might find in the search warrant. I have to see if he had a key that could give a way to get into this to commit this murder. I have to talk to him and get his statements. I have to see if the clothing, the shoes he have match what the witness says. I've got to look at what he's written about this event afterwards. I got to even look and see if his car matches the car that was seen. These are not pieces of direct evidence. These are indirect pieces of evidence. And if I have enough, I can move from the possibility of him being guilty to the most reasonable inference. Why? Because all of these pieces of evidence point to him. And these kinds of cases are very robust, usually. I don't typically do them with 8 pieces of evidence. I will usually have 80 pieces of evidence. And if I do it this way, it's not with eyewitnesses. This is called a circumstantial evidence case. Now, it turns out that what we're doing, by the way, in the book, Cold Case Christianity, I drew it this way. Here he is. Of course, if you use more pieces, I want a ton more pieces, maybe 10 times as many pieces. I call that death by 1,000 paper cuts. Got it? Now, why am I a Christian? Because when I first examined the Gospels to see if they were reliable, I had to build a case. And I built them on 4 aspects of eyewitness reliability. I've got a diagram for you. There it is. Death by 1,000 paper cuts. This is the large body of evidences that point to the Gospels as reliable. We're not going to cover that tonight. But my point is, that's an entirely circumstantial case. So what? Circumstantial evidence is every bit as valid as direct evidence. Did you know that? We even have a jury instruction for it. I'll show it to you. Here it is in California. Judges tell juries all the time that both direct and circumstantial evidence are acceptable types of evidence. In fact, neither is entitled to any greater weight than the other. So if you think it's just a circumstantial case, oh, that's all they have is a circumstance. Stop saying that. Because circumstantial evidence is to be used exactly with the same weight as direct evidence. So we can make a case for Christianity, and don't let anyone tell you that if you don't have an eyewitness who can say they saw it and they can stand right here to be cross-examined, you can't trust it. That's every case I work. Another thing about evidence. There's a difference between possible and reasonable. You know that, right? That's why the standard of proof is not beyond a possible doubt, it's beyond a reason. Why is it? Why is it beyond a reasonable doubt? Because anything and everything is possible. That's why possible doesn't count. Anything is possible. Who cares about what's possible? It's possible you're not even here. Oh, we've been telling you we're building a new sanctuary. No, we're not building a new sanctuary. We're just disguising the old one because you are now in the mothership. When you walked in the door, we immediately sprayed you with a little bit of alien and, you know, coma-inducing fluid. And now you think you're watching this. You're not even watching this. You're in a coma right now, imagining this as a group while you're being examined by aliens. That is at least possible, but it's not reasonable. So to help people to understand this, our effort here is to build a circumstantial cumulative case that gets us to beyond a reasonable doubt. We're not going to go beyond a possible doubt because you don't know anything beyond a possible doubt. You don't. There are people right now who are arguing that the entire universe is a computer simulation. Do you know that? Serious philosophers are arguing this. Anything is possible. But not everything is reasonable. And that's why reasonable is the judicial standard. Let me teach you another piece of evidence. Another thing about evidence is important. And that's that every case has unanswered questions. Oh, I can't believe Christianity is true unless I can remove all doubt. Really? Then you can't know anything. Because there's always unanswered questions. I'll even ask jurors before I put them on a jury, hey, are you the kind of person that needs to have every question answered before you can make a decision? Yeah, I think so, Jim. I need to have every question answered. You're excused. I cannot put you on a jury because I can't answer all your questions. This is a case I had. It's a Dateline case. You might have seen it on TV. It was just on TV about a week and a half ago. This man was arrested for killing his wife, and he got rid of her body, and he said that she ran off. And I could not answer some important questions for the jury because I had no body. So no body missing. I couldn't tell you where her body was, how he killed her, when he killed her, how he got rid of her body. I couldn't tell you how he moved her car to make it look like she ran off. I couldn't answer any of these questions. Now, lucky for us, he did change his story over time, and his changing story kind of gave him away. But at the end of all this, I didn't have answers to some of the most significant questions you could ask. And Keith Morrison, now he loves that kind of stuff. So he was just dogging me at the end of the interview, right? I don't even think he's the right guy, Jim. I think you got the wrong guy this time. Really? At sentencing, he confessed to the entire thing and gave us the location of the body. So we know we have the right guy. But I still couldn't answer those questions for the jury, and they convicted him in 4 hours. I want you to realize that you may have questions right now as somebody who's considering the claims of Christianity, or your friends may have questions, and they might say to you, I could never make a decision this profound unless every question is answered. These folks make decisions involving death penalty cases, even though they can't answer every question. And that's okay, because you can never answer every question. Here's the jury instruction for this. The evidence need not eliminate all possible doubt, because everything in life is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. So you can have some possible doubts about Christianity. They may not be reasonable doubts, though. That's the difference. Here's another instruction that's important. Witnesses never, ever agree, and their order of testimony matters. Oh, I see some differences between the Gospels. I've known people who were challenged in their faith because a professor told them to go home and read the passion narrative in all four Gospels and write down how they vary. And after doing that, this Christian was disturbed by how different the passion narratives seemed to be. That never bothered me when I first read this stuff, because I know that witnesses never agree. That's why the first thing I ask when I get called out in the middle of the night is really simple. The first thing I ask the dispatcher is, are officers still on the scene? Yep, they are. Okay, great. Have them separate the eyewitnesses. Why do I ask for that? That's the only thing I ask for. I don't ask for anything else. Because I know if you don't separate those eyewitnesses, when I get there, they'll have talked to each other, and they will give me the same story 4 times. I do not want the same story. That's not what real eyewitnesses sound like. I want you to hold on to your differences. Doesn't mean anyone's lying. Doesn't even mean anyone's wrong. It just means you're coming at this from a different perspective. And the order in which you are actually interviewed matters. Let me give you an example of this. Let's say I've got a robbery. The first witness I talk to gives me this description of the robber. He wore a white t-shirt and jeans. His hair was short. He yelled a lot. Okay, can you see here what she's doing? She's really trying to answer 3 key questions. What was he wearing? What did he look like, and what did he say? So he's got a white t-shirt and jeans, his hair is short, he yelled a lot. Now the next person comes along, and I've separated my witnesses, so they can't hear what each other is saying, that's good. And sure enough, the second witness I interview says something slightly different. T-shirt's the same, but now he's got jeans, his hair was blonde. That's new. And he demanded money. But you can at least say he is answering the same 3 questions, just slightly differently. What did he wear? What did he look like? What did he say? I get a third person. He's been separated, so he doesn't hear what the first two say. He says he had a short sleeve shirt and jeans. Doesn't say it's t-shirt. White guy. Oh, that's new. He screamed at the clerk. Slightly different, but he at least is answering the same 3 questions. What did he wear? What did he look like? What did he say? Now, you see in the shadows here, there's another guy. And if I'm not careful and I don't know that that's a witness and I allow him to overhear the first 3 witnesses, that's going to mess everything up. So now he's heard what the first 3 said. Now he identifies himself as a witness. Really? Why didn't someone separate this guy? Why didn't somebody identify him? Okay, come on over. Tell me what do you know? And he now offers something somewhat different. Having heard the first 3, he now comes over and here's what his statement is. He says, you know, he's a regular customer. Really? That's afterwards, he ran out to a white van. What? The first 3 were answering these questions. What did he wear? What did he look like? What did he say? And this one now comes up with these 2 kinds of questions. Well, who was he? And what did he do afterward? Why is he doing that? Well, something similar happens in the Gospels. It's all about order. He knew what the first 3 had said, so his goal in his mind was to fill in the blanks. Now, I don't want you to fill in the blanks. Pretend like you didn't hear them. Just go back and start at the beginning and give me the whole thing from the beginning. But if you don't stop somebody to have them do that, he will just fill in the blanks. Now, let's go, for example, to the Gospels. We have a description of the Lord's Supper. First witness, someone like Mark, says, hey, they were reclining at the table and eating. And Jesus said, truly I say to you that one of you will betray me. Okay, here the author is trying to answer these 2 questions. Where were they? What did Jesus say? Here comes another account. from Matthew. As they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you that one of you will betray me." Slightly different, but at least he's answering the same two questions. Go to Luke. "But behold, the hand of the one betraying me is with mine on the table." Oh, that's a little different. But it is answering the same two questions. Then we get to the last gospel. A gospel written last, and actually it's clear that this gospel author is aware of what the first three had said already. So John comes along and he says this. He says, "There was reclining on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples, whom Jesus loved. So when he had dipped the morsel, he took it and gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot." This is all new information, okay? "After the morsel, Satan then entered into him." This is all new. "Therefore, Jesus said to him, 'What you do, do quickly.'" Really? The other two were answering these questions. This is not John's intention at all. John's answering these two questions. Who's his favorite? And why did Jesus, did Judas do this? Well, what is that? What's going on there? Again, it's because he is being interviewed last. Witnesses never totally agree. And he, like my other witness, is trying to fill in the blanks. Don't let someone tell you that differences between the gospel is what invalidates them. In fact, it's the differences between the gospels that validate them, that make them reliable. If God's intention was to get us four accounts that we could examine with the skill set we need to examine reliable eyewitness testimony and determine that they were in fact reliable, he did a great job. Because that's what we have. Let me give you another instruction. Witnesses could be wrong, yet still be reliable. Now, I'm not suggesting that any of our biblical witnesses are wrong, but just for sake of argument with your friends who are really are skeptics, okay, you think there's something wrong in there? I don't think there is. But even if there was, you couldn't throw it to the curb. We don't allow that in jury trials. Here's another trial from another Dateline case. This is from 1988, maybe. This woman was killed. This man killed her in a Kentucky Fried Chicken in our city. I'll give you a little bit of the preview. I've got some sound here, so get ready in the back if there's some sound that you can run. That thumb up means he's good to go. So here we go.
The mystery was born on the night before Halloween, more than a quarter century ago. A young woman traded shifts with a friend of hers, went to work at a fast food restaurant, never came home again. And for 25 years, her family wondered, who did this thing? Will justice ever be served? Then along came a detective who took a look at the pictures of the crime scene one more time, took a look at the evidence to see, is there anything here that can fit together? The difference between this particular detective and most people in the field was simply this. He had trained as an architect. And some things about the way we train make us see the world in a different way. It also happened to solve the mystery of what happened the night before Halloween.
Halloween. Don't you love Keith Morrison? Crazy. He's crazy. Anyway, my background, I was an architect before I became a police officer. I came in late. But this helped me a little bit here because I was dealing with this. What he said was so important because the woman who was working that night was not supposed to be working that night. She traded shifts with a coworker who wanted to go on a date. That coworker decided she would work the next day. The coworker for 23 years blamed herself for getting Robin Hoynes murdered because she always felt that was supposed to be her. That morning, she came to work on a Saturday. She was murdered on a Friday night. On Saturday morning, she came to work, and she saw immediately, and this is her standing talking to, and here she is here too. And she saw Robin's car was in the parking lot, and that started to spook her immediately because she realized Robin's car shouldn't be there. Robin should be going home. So she ran to the door, and she opened the door, and she discovered Robin inside. Now, at the trial, this woman's name was Karen. We asked Karen, hey, the doorknob, just tell us, was that thing locked or unlocked? Because it would help us, because we wanted to know, did the person have a key to get in? Did Robin let that person in? This became a critical question. Was the door unlocked when you ran through it to see if Robin was inside? And she couldn't remember. As a matter of fact, she guessed it, and she guessed it wrong. So now I've got her mistaken about the locked door. You think that defense attorney, he tried to eat her up. You can't trust anything Karen is telling you. One of the most important issues is whether the door is unlocked, and she got that wrong. So she's wrong about that detail, but the jury says, please, give me a break. They found her to be reliable, even though she was wrong about the door. Why? Because we instruct jurors. A witness can be mistaken, yet still be reliable. Why? Because you might explain why it is she's mistaken. Look, she was so panicked that she ran through that door. She wasn't thinking about anything from the car to the body, because she already knew something was up. And that explained why she was wrong about the door. So we have a jury instruction for this. I'll show it to you. Judges say this all the time. Do not automatically reject testimony just because it's got inconsistencies or conflicts. Consider whether the differences are important or not. People sometimes honestly forget things or make mistakes about what they do remember. Also, two people may witness the same event yet see or hear it differently. This is the Gospels. Do not be shaken by this. This is just part of working cases. I'm going to jump ahead a few jury instructions here. This is something that drives me nuts. I want to cover it with you. There is a difference between a fact and an inference. This drives me crazy. People will say things are facts when they're not facts. They're just inferences from facts. Here's what I mean. Facts and inferences differ in this regard. You have pieces of evidence, and then you have the conclusion you draw from these pieces of evidence, what you infer to be true. Those are inferences. And by the way, it's not as simple as just evidences and inferences, because there's a lot of stuff in your head that determines how you view things. Your own, I wish it was just about jury instructions. But it's not just about jury instructions. I could teach you about evidence, and you still might come to a different conclusion about the evidence. Why? Because you've been wired a certain way. You have certain likes and dislikes, a own personal history that's different than mine. And you have things you want to be true and things that you don't want to be true and passions you feel strongly about. These things end up making a big impact on what you think is true. Forget about the evidence. It could just be you. We start off with one place and we end up in different locations. Why? Because the things that drive us to different conclusions are all about our own personal history and desires. It's that stuff. Why do I say that? Because if I'm going to look at evidence, like, for example, evidence from biology. I know people who look at the evidence from biology, and they say, you know what? From that evidence, I can tell you that I believe evolution is true. And they will say evolution's a fact. Forget about whether or not evolution is true for a second. Whatever it is, it's not a fact. It's an inference from facts. Got it? In other words, I wrote a book called God's Crime Scene. And in it, I looked at all the same biological evidence that these neo-Darwinists have been looking at and conclude that evolution is true. Yet I look at the same evidence and I'm like, no, there's an intelligent designer. Clearly God is the creator of all this stuff. And I'm using the exact same evidence. Well, what's going on here? It's that stuff. It's what do we want to be true sometimes dictates what we think is true. Be careful it's not us doing that as Christians either. Also, when you hear this expression, it drives me nuts, settled science. How many times have you heard that? What a terrible sentence. What a terrible expression. There's no such thing as settled science. Science, if it was settled, we still would believe in theories that we've changed in the last 10 years. We learn something, we change our inference, right? Science isn't settled. I think you could argue that the facts are settled. Okay, I got a fingerprint at the crime scene. That's a fact. I can't change that. But what I infer from that fact is going to depend on a lot of other things. That stuff's not settled. So just make sure when someone tells you that something is settled science, it should be a little flag going off in your head. These are inferences. One last thing. Causal explanations. Everyone has a burden of proof. Have you ever heard this said? Oh, you believe in God? Well, then it's your burden of proof, because I don't see a God anywhere here. You believe in this thing I can't see? It's on you to make the case. I don't have to make a case. I don't believe in this imaginary thing you believe in. It's not my burden to make a case for what I clearly don't see. If you think this is out there, you have to make the case. Really? That's not how it works. If I go to a crime scene and I see certain pieces of evidence in the crime scene, and then my partner says, oh, I think that the coworker did it. And I might say, no, I think you're wrong. I think his girlfriend did it. Well, I have a burden of proof to show why this evidence is best explained by the girlfriend. But he also has a burden of proof to show why he thinks this is best explained by the coworker. Make sense? Well, in the universe, I think there are 8 pieces of evidence. I won't go into all the detail now, but basically it's the beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the origin of life in the universe, the appearance of design and biology in the universe, minds and free agency in the universe, and finally, objective moral truths and the problem of evil, a standard of good by which we could judge anything and call it evil. These are the evidences in the universe. If you think you know somebody who says, yeah, I can get all that stuff with just physics and space, time, and matter. I don't need any God. Just use physics. I can get all that stuff. Okay, fine. Show me how you can get that with physics. That burden's on you. Now, I think God is the best explanation for these eight things. And I have no problem taking on that burden to show you why I think God is the best explanation. But don't think that you don't have a burden also because you think you can get that with physics. That's on you. Show me how you can get it with physics. By the way, that's going to be a very short conversation. At some point, though, once you've instructed your jury, you have to start making a case. People tell me all the time, I love John Lewin. He's so great on TV, and he's so eager. He's so prepared. He's so passionate. They'll say he's passionate. Oh, I hear this all the time. John is so passionate. He's fearless, they'll say. They'll say he's so enthusiastic. Really? I know John, okay? He's none of those things, all right? All right? He's like my best friend, okay? I know John. You know what John is? John is simply prepared. That's it. Prepared. And there is a relationship between your preparation and your enthusiasm. Did you know that? There is. So, for example, how many of you have, remember when you were in college or you were in high school? There'd be a day where they would say, it's going to be a test on Friday. Okay, great. Oh, test on Friday. Great. So the day of the test shows up, right? And on Friday, on the day of the test, there's some jerk who shows up in class and he is so excited. It's test day. Ever know anyone like that? You want to choke that guy, right? He is so excited. Why is he so excited? The rest of us, we're like, hey, it's test day. No, not him. He's excited. Well, you know why he's excited? Because he's all studied up. He's all prepared. He wants to shine today. He knows he's ready to take that test. The rest of us, not so much. This is the difference. When you're prepared, you're suddenly excited. So why is it we're not excited about sharing the gospel on the street with people we know? Why is it we go a whole year without talking to any? Why is it when I get on the plane, I sometimes want to put my headphones on first? You do it too. Why do we do that? I wonder if it's because we're not really prepared. So I want to give you a few tips on how to be prepared, okay? I have a friend, his name is Jim Bricardo, and he wrote a book called Unsilenced. And here's what he does. He has one sentence prepared in advance of any meeting with anyone. I don't care who you are, on the street, on a street corner, at a restaurant. He asks the same question. You could be a complete stranger, trust me, because he knows if I just get past the first 30 seconds, it's all downhill. Your fear is of the first 30 seconds. Did you know that? You're afraid because you don't know how to get past the first 30 seconds. Trust me, a minute into this conversation, it's easy now. You're talking now. It's how do I start? It's really intimidating. He starts the same way every time. Asks a simple question. Hey, what do you think happens when you die? Look how fast you can ask that question. What do you think happens when you can die? It turns out there's only like three ways to answer this question. People will say, oh, I think you're going to heaven or you go to hell. Well, that means there's some form of theist. You can start having conversations. They'll say, I think you'll go back in the dirt. There's some form of atheist. They'll say, I think, yeah, you know, it's like one of those things where we're spiritual beings. You know, we kind of recycle based on karma. So you got some new age kind of an answer. Well, once you only know there's only like three ways to answer this. Number one, the question is diagnostic. It tells you where people are. And number two, if you kind of get good at answering those three objections, those three responses, you got it down. You've got it mastered. He is excellent at this because he starts off knowing how he's going to begin. I want you to think about that too. How would you begin a conversation? I have another friend. You can tell age based on names, I think. This guy's name is James, so he's probably about my age. I have a friend named Grover Peterson. He's maybe a little bit older, you think? He starts off this way. Everything in life has a design, a function, a purpose. What's yours? He'll start off with, hey, that's a nice watch. Looks designed. You know, everything that's been designed has a purpose. What's your purpose? Because that gets him into a discussion about design. He really wants to talk about how you've been designed by a holy God. But he starts off by things that are designed have a purpose. So what is your purpose? If you think you have a purpose, well, then you can go back to the designer. You see how he's kind of working his way back to the discussion of the creator. I think it's pretty brilliant, right? So here's my takeaway for you guys tonight. I want you to start thinking about what your opening line is going to be. Simple. Create one. Could be anything, but just know that's what you're going to say to overcome the first 30 seconds of fear. John also captures momentum. This is huge, right? Because you got to start off. You got to start off with momentum. Look, you have this process, right, which is your jury selection process. If you start stumbling out of the gate, if your opening is too weak, well, then, man, it's all uphill. If this is small, then everything else is a climb. Oh, my gosh. So what we try to do in the beginning is we want to capture momentum. We want to say something that really captures their attention, which is why I think that first opening line, you know, what is your purpose? That's a good way to start, right? Because then if you start off big, it's just a matter of making good on your promises. I've got another friend who has kind of mastered this as well. And when people ask him, why do you think there's a God? Like, what is your evidence for God? What do you think is the best evidence for God? You know what he says? By the name, his young guy, his name is Ryan Moore. He always says this, best evidence for God? Evil. Clearly. That captures your attention right away, doesn't it? Really, evil's best evidence for God? Sure, he says it this way. When you describe something as truly, transcendently evil, you are unwittingly acknowledging the existence of a true, objective, transcendent standard of good. But if there isn't a transcendent, objectively good God to act as that standard, then evil is nothing more than a matter of your personal opinion. True evil requires a true standard of good by which to measure it. That's why evil is evidence for God's existence. Crazy, huh? He starts off strong, then it's all downhill. And at some point, you have to make the case with evidence. I want you to master, look, good case makers are not full of themselves. They're self-effacing. John is incredibly self-effacing. Why? Because we're going to have a ton of time in front of the jury. And we want the jury during this trial to be focused on the evidence we introduce and the testimony of witnesses. What we don't want is for the jury to be focused on the jerk who's the attorney. So we're not going to be a jerk. We want to be invisible. We don't want to draw the attention to ourselves. We want the case to be the case. That makes sense? Because in the end, we don't want them to say yes or no. We want them just to, this is the other thing too. You're only going to see that piece of evidence for a short time. That's it. It's going to be introduced. You're going to see it for a day. Then it's going to go away. You're not going to see it again. But that knucklehead who presented that evidence to you, you're going to see him for 6 weeks. So we don't want you to make a decision based on him. We want you to make it based on the evidence, not who's presenting the evidence. Now, why do I say that? Well, you've done some street evangelism, right? You go out on the streets, you make a case to somebody who's never heard the gospel, you're going to be in front of that guy for about 6 minutes. That's one kind of evangelism. They're only going to see you for a short time. But now you've got people in your life that you love who are not believers. And you're going to be at them in Thanksgiving coming up. And they're going to see you all day. And they've been watching you for 20 years. This is why with my dad, my son and I know that we have to continue to model Christ for him. Because if we don't, and he's going to be looking at us for a long time. So we know this burden's on us. So you got to be self-effacing, you got to be gracious. That make sense? That's about how we would actually deliver. I've got just a little bit of time. Let me just go with this a few more seconds here. You also have to be preemptive. Preemptive. Here's what I mean by that. Do you know that when we get a trial, the defense shows us everything they're going to present in front of the judge before they do it? And we present to the defense everything that we're going to show. There's no surprises in a jury trial. We show them all of our evidence before we even begin. Both sides show each other, they're supposed to at least, and that's called discovery. So by the time we get to trial and there's a piece of evidence that's brought in, I don't care who brings it in, when this guy shows it to the jury, there's really no surprise. It's not like on TV, I got this new piece of evidence that no one's ever seen before. No, there are no surprises in jury trials because both sides already know what the other side's going to present. We know everything there is to know about that wazoo piece of evidence. And we know everything there is to know about this knucklehead who's presenting it. We do our research on him, too. Why do I say that to you? Because it turns out that you have a burden as a Christian to do some discovery. They already know your side. The culture already knows they're post-Christian right now. So you have a case, right? They're making a case against Christianity all the time. And you could actually read it if you wanted to. Do you know what these people are writing about Christianity right now? They're saying some pretty amazing things.
You should know what they're saying. How will you know how to respond if you don't know what they're saying? There's a matter of discovery that has to be done for you guys too. You need to know everything about these bad ideas, and you need to know everything about the people who hold those bad ideas. It's the same as in a jury trial. You cannot do your case effectively if you don't know what they're saying. Finally, we got to close. You got to close an argument in front of people. Have you noticed in dog yards there are two kinds of dogs? You know, there's little yappy dogs, right? I hate yappy dogs. I had a Chihuahua for years. I wanted to kick it every day. Seriously, don't you? Anybody here have a Chihuahua? Raise your hand. Let's pray for these people right now. Because you know, in a yard full of dogs, that Chihuahua is always the meanest, nastiest dog in the yard. Why? Because it has an inferiority complex that it wants to make up with noise. Now, meanwhile, in the same yard, you introduce a Great Dane. Great Dane comes in, doesn't make a sound at all, never barks, never has to bark. Why? Because it's huge. It has nothing to prove. It's not trying to puff up. Now, do you realize when it comes to all worldviews that are out there, ways of which you can see the world, Christianity is the one worldview that actually describes the world accurately. It stands up. Some of the best philosophers in the country, in the world today, are Christians. Did you know that? And they're renowned. They are respected because Christianity, it turns out, when it comes to worldviews, Christianity is the big dog. So my question is, why do you sound like a Chihuahua? And sometimes we do. Like it's fight or flight. Someone challenges us, we get all puffed up, we get all nasty about it. I know, because we role play as atheists at churches around the country, Sean McDowell and I, and it doesn't take but 15 minutes into the role playing when the audience turns incredibly nasty. Look, we're just role playing as atheists. We're not really atheists, okay? And they get nasty. Why? Because they're not sure, they can't defend themselves. And when they run out of ways to defend themselves, they start to get barky. Don't do that. Know the case well enough to know that you do not have to act like a Chihuahua. You are the big dog. And last thing, when we do cases, it's not just a single attorney who's presenting the case in front of a jury. That attorney has help behind the scenes, paralegals, other attorneys they consult with. And they have people in the office who are actually supporting them on a daily basis with information and advice, support. Also, they're the cops who started the whole process, who are there to provide information to them, answer questions, and run errands and do all kinds of other stuff that we had to do. And then there are experts that are actually going to testify on that. In the end, what I'm trying to say here is that this is a team effort. Every criminal trial is a team effort. Now, I bet there have been times when you felt like your efforts to share the gospel, to share what Jesus did for us, feels like a game of tennis. I felt this way because I would be with my dad talking to my dad. It's like it's just you and the other person in that net, right? You hit it, he hits it back. You hit it, he hits it back. You hit it, oh, it's out of bounds. Oh, it's all on you. You hit it out of bounds. It's all your fault. You didn't win today. It's just you and him. It's not the way this works. It's not a game of tennis. Evangelism is a game of baseball. And some people take years to run the bases. And we as a team are going to work to help them go from base to base. Here's how I drew it in Forensic Faith. It's a team effort. There's times when I'm sure you feel this way. When I'm going to see my dad, right? I do chapels for the Green Bay Packers. Don't ask me how that started. But anyway, so I will follow the Packers around. I've got a chapel this year in Detroit on New Year's Eve. Green Bay is playing in Detroit. So I'm taking my dad. I'm going to fly into Dallas, drive out and get him, go back to Dallas, fly to Detroit. And we're going to do the chapel, and then we're going to have Sunday and watch the game. And I know I will feel compelled on that day to hit a home run. I wish I could say something that would bring him to faith on that day. I think we all feel that way. Like we have to hit home runs. Oh, we haven't done anything positive. That's not true. Look, you don't know where people are standing on the base path. They might just be on first base. They might be on third. You don't know where they are. You do not have to hit a home run. Make contact with the ball. That's it. Just get off your butt, get off the bench, go up to the, just try to bunt. Just do something. And that little thing you're going to do that causes them to think seriously for the first time, it's going to advance them on the base path. And then later on, I hear people all the time, yeah, you know, I didn't take this seriously, but 10 years ago, someone said this to me, and then 5 years ago, my daughter got married, and her husband was talking to me at dinner, and then six, and they got like a 10-year story of how the case for Christianity was presented to them, or how the gospel was slowly revealed to them. So this is why when I'm out and I'm talking to people and I really want to share my faith, because I don't know if I'm moving them from first to second, I could be, or from second to third, or from third to home, I don't know where I'm moving them, I don't get hung up on it anymore. I don't. If I can get a home run, great. But if I don't get a home run, I'm okay with it. Because you don't know where they are. Now, on the other hand, if I'm talking to somebody and they come to faith right in front of me, I don't take too much credit for that either, right? Because I've had people will do this, right? And they'll come back and say, hey, I taught a little guy to Christ. Yeah, congratulations, that's good. But remember, he was on third base leaning in from 10 years of other people hitting bunts. So shut up, okay? Don't get too full of yourself, because, you know, you don't blame yourself if you can't move them, and don't credit yourself if he moves, because this is a team sport. It's a sport of baseball. But you do have an obligation, and that is to get off your butt and do something. Now, I've said it before, that cops do have a tendency to see the world between two extremes, sheep and wolves. I want to leave you with this duty, a calling for all of you. We think, as cops, that we have to protect sheep from wolves. This is our job. That's why all the sheepdog ministries in America are cop or military ministries. Why? Because we see the sheepdog as the other animal in the yard that protects the sheep from the wolves. And by the way, the sheep do not like wolves. And they don't like sheepdogs. They don't. They're annoying. They're always pushing them around, telling them what to do. They bark. They sound. They're both canines. They're both in the same family. So I'm not surprised that sheep don't like sheepdogs. I get that. Now, we're described as sheep in the Bible, right? That's not a compliment. Because sheep are super stupid. Okay, they are. And they have no idea what they're even getting picked off by wolves. But I'll tell you, sheepdogs are important, because if we had a yard full of sheepdogs, we would not have a wolf problem. We have a wolf problem both in culture and in the church, because we don't have enough sheepdogs. We have a lot of sheep. Everyone in this room, you're in a great church. I know this church, okay? And you know you're in a great church. And regardless of what happens with this building going forward, if you guys can't survive the next 4 months to be in a church like this, then shame on you. Get out of here now. You don't even deserve to be here. Seriously. So I'm telling you, you can get through the next 4 months no problem, because you're in a place where Jack is slowly turning sheep into sheepdogs. And that's what we're called to do. Now, the kind of sheepdog is all I'm trying to encourage you. I know in this church you're going to be a sheepdog. But I want you to be a certain kind. I went running with my wife in the foothills here, and I'll tell you, we saw a post. I am not kidding you. On this run, we saw a post where somebody had posted a picture of a lost dog, and you know what it was. It was a Chihuahua. And if you saw that picture in that environment of that little lost Chihuahua, you know what we're thinking, right? That ain't good. Now, had that Chihuahua been a Great Dane, we would not have worried about it, because Great Danes can survive in that environment. Now, if you were to go look for that Chihuahua, where are you going to look? I'm going to check every coyote dropping from here to the end of that trail, because that's where your little Chihuahua is, right there, okay? Right? Okay. Now, if you had a Great Dane, I'm not going to look at those droppings, because Great Danes can survive. I'm going to go to the pound, and that's where the shelter. That's where the Great Dane's going to be. So my question for all of you as you leave here tonight, and I'm calling you to be sheepdogs, is which of these two will you be? Don't bark, make a lot of noise, and don't be in the coyote dropping. Make sense? Let's pray. Father, we love you, and we know that we are called to defend what we believe. When people have questions for the reason, they want reasons for the hope we have. We know we're called to give them those reasons. So help us to be that kind of Christian that will take the time to offer the evidence. And help us to make the gospel our priority, Father. Help us to see it as the most important truth we will ever know. Help us to speak it, to live it, to demonstrate to the people around us, Father. Help us to not be lazy. Help us to see what you want us to do. And just help us to get off the bench and to get in the game. We pray this in the name of your precious Son, Jesus Christ. And everyone here says,
amen.
Amen. Thanks, guys.